them to take you away. Z started toward the exit. She was at the door when she heard him say something. Z hurried back to the side of his bed where she stared at him for a long moment.
I asked you why you let them take you away and lock you up, and you answered me, didn't you?
She waited. More silence. Again she turned, walking back to the door.
There it was again.
Only this time she heard it loud and clear. He'd said one word.
Love.
He'd done it for love. As Z made her way to the elevator and out of the hospital, she tried to figure out what Nathaniel had been trying to say. Did he know where his wife had run off to? Z couldn't help but think he loved her so much, he didn't want the world to find her and judge her. Had he been willing to give up his daughter and waste away in a cell in the name of love? It made no sense. And yet Z knew that her dad would do something stupid like that if he thought it would save her in any way. He would sacrifice his life and his happiness for her. It was a parent thing. She was pretty lucky, now that she thought about it. 41. Jesse glanced at the time as she drove slowly by the house belonging to Olaf Hagnevik in North Natomas. It was 2:33 p.m. After the debacle with Shia Cohen, Jesse had returned to her office to continue researching the list of names of people who might have it out for Jason Geiger. One name stood out above all the others. Olaf Hagnevik. Like Brody Hoffman, Olaf Hagnevik owned a construction company that had done the majority of work on a shopping center in the city of Lincoln. That was only 2 years ago. Upon completion, Olaf submitted the final bill and never got paid. He was owed more than $200,000. That had begun the demise of the Olaf Hagnevik company and a beautiful friendship. Confident he could recover the money owed him, Olaf Hagnevik took Jason to court. By then, JHG and its plethora of lawyers were like a well-oiled machine when it came to defending themselves in court and getting away with not paying people they owed. After reading the court transcript, Hagnevik versus JHG, Jesse had gone back to other cases where JHG had refused to pay. To date, dozens of suits had been filed against Jason Geiger and his company. There were also liens and judgments against JHG because of failure to pay. It was becoming clear to Jesse that JHG had a system. Jason's team of lawyers would financially overpower smaller companies, keeping them in court and draining their resources until the people or the company that was owed money either settled for much less or gave up getting paid altogether. Jesse pulled to the curb and shut off the engine. Sitting in the middle of a big lot, at least 5 acres, was a one-story house. The front window was cracked. Shingles were missing from the roof. She grabbed her purse and case file and climbed out of the car. The stairs to the porch creaked under her weight. Seconds after rapping her knuckles against the door, it opened. He looked just like the photos she'd seen online. Olaf Hagnevik had a smooth, hairless scalp. More than 6 feet tall, he towered over her. If he wasn't built like a boxer, she might have felt a little more at ease. Much like Shia Cohen had done, he let his gaze wander. Shia had looked her over as if to demean and humiliate her. This guy was just plain intimidating. Unlike Shia, he appeared to like what he saw despite her casual wear.
My name is Jesse Cole. I'm a private investigator, and I'm looking for Jason Geiger and his wife.
Jason Geiger,
he said in a voice so deep it vibrated.
I was sort of hoping I would never hear that name again.
His wife, Lacey Geiger, is actually the person I need to find. The last time she was seen, she was with Jason. So I'm talking to friends, family, people who...
Who were fucked in the ass by him?
She swallowed the lump in her throat.
Sorry about what happened. I read the transcript from the hearing. You and Jason used to be good friends, is that right?
He said nothing, just stared at her.
You knew him back in college. Spent time with him before his business took off. He's not well-liked, that got a laugh. I've talked to his neighbor and mother and people at his work, but I'm getting nowhere fast. I thought maybe...
Maybe I had something to do with his disappearance?
She blushed. He was right about that, but it was in her best interest to play it cool. No. Actually, I was hoping you would know things about Jason that might help me find him. For instance, did he have a favorite place he liked to go to unwind? His silence made her one-sided conversation awkward. Like I said, he was with his wife. Jesse plodded along. They were seen leaving for dinner, but that was it. Nobody has seen either one of them since. I figured it wouldn't hurt to talk to you. He opened the door wider and gestured for her to come inside. His hands and work boots were caked with dirt. It was in that moment she realized she'd left her gun in the glove compartment. Damn. She looked over her shoulder at her car parked on the curb. She still hadn't gotten used to keeping her gun with her at all times.
Coming in or not?
It wasn't his obvious strength that intimidated her. It was his calm, emotionless demeanor that made her feel as if he were daring her to enter his lair. She took the dare and stepped inside. Not only did he shut the door, he also locked it.
That way,
he said, gesturing to a room she couldn't yet see. She could feel his breath on the top of her head as she walked through a narrow hall. The place was cluttered, dirty. She thought about making an excuse along with a quick exit. Instead, she entered the family room and took a seat when he pointed to the couch. Beer cans were scattered across the tables and floor. She pulled out her notebook and pen, relieved when he took a seat in his recliner.
So what do you want to know?
He asked. Years ago, Jesse said. You and Jason were friends. If he had gone missing at that time, I am assuming you would have wanted him to be found. Is there anywhere, a cabin, a camping ground, a friend's house, that you would think he might have gone to?
Nope. All he cared about was making money.
He didn't play poker with the guys or meet you at a bar for drinks?
Nope.
Olaf rubbed his forehead.
I don't think you understand. Nobody wanted to be around the guy. Jason is an asshole, period.
Can you elaborate? Olaf chuckled.
Sure. Jason never made any effort to understand or empathize with others. He acted only in his own self-interest. He was cruel. He liked to demean people. He only dated women with low self-esteem so he could easily control them. He never cared about anyone but himself.
So why did you remain friends for so long?
Because we were pals. No matter how he treated others, I never for a second thought he would pull that shit on me.
He rubbed a large hand over his smooth, shiny head.
He fucked me over good, though. I never saw it coming.
Did you know Lacey? She asked next.
Yeah, sure. Seemed like a nice enough girl. She fit the bill, as I just described.
Low self-esteem?
That's right. A people pleaser with no confidence.
Olaf's jaw hardened.
If Jason was standing here right now,
he said,
do you know what I would do?
She shook her head. What?
I would kill him.
Jesse's stomach quivered. A dog barked. Jesse jumped to her feet. Olaf stood and walked around his chair to the sliding door, opening it wide. The backyard was nothing but a wide expanse of tall green grass and foxtail. The German Shepherd rushed inside and gave Jesse a good sniffing before trotting back to Olaf. Jesse gestured toward the piles of dirt outside. Looks like I caught you in the middle of a project.
Yep. I'm fixing a failed septic system.
He scratched his jaw.
I don't know what to say about Jason and Lacey. If I knew where he might have gone off to, I would tell you.
Jesse nodded.
My guess,
he added,
is that Jason is either running from the law or he finally pissed off the wrong guy.
Meaning?
I think you know what I mean.
He gave her a tight smile.
I should get back to work. You can let yourself out.
Sure, thanks. He shut the slider and then trudged through the grass, his dog at his side. She didn't know what to think about Olaf Hagnevik. Was he the wrong guy who Jason had pissed off? Had Olaf learned from the best and finally gotten his revenge? On the drive back to her office, something gnawed at Jessie. It wasn't her talk with Olaf Hagnevik that replayed over and over in her mind. Instead, she kept thinking about her conversation with Brody Hoffman, top man on Jason's list of enemies. Although there was nothing particularly threatening about Hoffman, not at all intimidating like Olaf Hagnevik, Hoffman had an unnatural stillness about him. But that wasn't the only thing that bothered her. He was no longer married, and yet she was certain she'd seen a purse sticking out from under a pile of clothes on the chair in the bedroom when she'd poked her head inside. It was never a good thing to assume, though. He could have a sister or a girlfriend. And yet nothing in the house had hinted at even a touch of femininity. She pulled to the side of the road, dug around inside her purse for her recorder that she'd had playing during her visit with Brody Hoffman. She rewound the tape to the beginning, hit play, then merged back onto the main road, listening while she drove. She was nearing Sacramento when she heard him say,
"I never once saw or met his wife, Lacey. I'm going to have to ask you to leave."
Her heart skipped a beat. Again, she pulled over and rewound the tape.
"I never once saw or met his wife, Lacey. I'm going to have to ask you to leave."
But how did he know her name was Lacey if he'd never met her? Maybe Jason had talked about Lacey when they worked together. But that was years ago. She looked through previous addresses on her navigator and tapped the one in Elk Grove. It would take her 35 minutes to get to Brody Hoffman's residence. As she merged back onto the road, she considered all her options. Talk to him again, press him for answers, find a way to get back into that bedroom and see if the purse was still there, or call for help. She sighed. It was too soon to call the police, since she had zero proof that Brody Hoffman had anything at all to do with Jason and Lacey's disappearance. They would shrug her off if she tried. No missing persons report. No worried friends or family members. One worried neighbor and an investigator with news for Lacey Geiger wouldn't cut it. She would go with her first option and talk to Brody Hoffman a second time, see if she could get him to squirm. With time to spare on the long drive, she called Z to get an update on the Arlene Snyder case. No answer. Next, she tried Colin. She hadn't heard from him in days. Again. No answer. Where was everyone?
42. Fuck. He couldn't stop thinking about the nosy investigator. What was her name?
Pushing himself from the couch, he started looking around the house. There it was. On the kitchen counter. Her business card. Jessie Cole Detective Agency. Back at his computer in the family room, next to his gaming video, he plopped down on the couch and entered the address to her website. It popped up right away. Clean and simple, easy to navigate. Apparently, her specialty was finding missing persons. On his feet again, he paced the floor. His mind swirled with speculation. His head throbbed. After a while, he picked up the remote, turned on the television, and flipped through the local news channels. Not one anchor mentioned anything about Jason Geiger and his wife being missing. If they had been reported missing, wouldn't it be on the news? No way. Ridiculous. It wasn't as if Jason Geiger was the mayor or anything. Nobody even liked the guy. He'd been planning his revenge on Jason Geiger for years. No fucking way was he going to let a stupid little investigator like Jessie Cole screw everything up for him. Nothing made any sense. Her list of names had been long. She'd simply lucked out in coming to see him. That had to be it. He couldn't think of any reason why he would have been singled out of so many disgruntled people. Was Jessie Cole lucky or incredibly clever? Back in front of his computer, he did a search on her name. Jesus, she was everywhere. Fucking pain in the ass. Ah, he said when he realized she was the investigator who had identified and helped take down the heartless killer. He tapped away at the keyboard. She had also shot a lawyer in a public park in Midtown. She was trigger-happy, and because of it, her gun license had been revoked. Good to know. His leg bounced up and down as he tried to think. He should have gotten rid of her while he had the chance. What had he been thinking, allowing her inside? She was pushy. She hadn't given him a chance to say no. A thought struck him, and he jumped up. His heart raced as he ran around the house, looking underneath lampshades and tables, searching for listening devices or cameras. Investigators could be tricky. He should know. He'd spent years doing his own investigative work on Jason Geiger. He was exhausted by the time he'd searched the entire house. He sat down. It took him a few minutes to calm himself. Wait a minute, he thought to himself. He got up, walked across the room, and opened the front door. The cops would have come already if the investigator had been on to him. He was fine. Everything was fine. 43. The building that housed the Sacramento Tribune looked to Colin like nothing more than a cement block with windows. He wondered how much longer the newspaper would last in the growing digital age. Ian Savage, the publisher, had agreed to meet with him this morning to talk about the death of Roger Willis. Savage hadn't pressed for details. If he had, Colin wanted to be sure his bias toward Ian's top crime reporter was not apparent. As far as Colin was concerned, there was a good chance Ben Morrison had killed Roger Willis. For now, though, he'd keep that tidbit to himself. Even if Morrison admitted he'd killed Roger Willis, Colin would still need solid physical evidence to support his confession. It was imperative that Colin kept his dislike for Morrison in check while he weighed the facts. They had a pool of potential suspects, and each needed to be looked at closely. A lot of the work Colin did was not particularly exciting, let alone interesting, but no matter what, it was his responsibility to make sure his team was on the right side of the law, all the way to the end. He climbed out from behind the wheel of his car, shut the door, and headed across the parking lot. Up ahead, he spotted Ben Morrison getting out of his van. He had a parking spot up front, closer to the building. Ben saw him coming and waited for him to approach. Together, they walked side by side toward the main entrance.
"What are you doing here?"
Ben asked.
"Just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Checking my alibi, are you?
It's all part of the process."
"Let's be straight with one another,"
Ben said as they walked.
"You had a problem with me even before I contacted Jessie about her sister."
Colin stopped a few steps away from the entry door.
"Okay, since you've gone there, why were you in the car with Sophie on the night she died?"
"I wish I knew."
"I bet you do." "That's the problem with you, Grayson. You can't handle the truth even when it's staring right at you. Whether you want to believe it or not, I don't remember anything before the accident. I don't know why I was in that car with Sophie Cole."
There was a short pause before Ben added,
"I get it, though. In your attempt to protect Jesse, you've pegged me as the bad guy. Bottom line, I think you have a tendency to take everything I do personally."
For Jesse's sake, Colin had been trying to see Ben Morrison in a different light, an innocent, guiltless light. But it wasn't easy for Colin to do. What Ben didn't understand was that his estimation of Ben was a gut feeling, a vibration, good old intuition, and Colin felt it every single time he was around him.
"What about the write-up you did about police becoming more concerned about drugs than homicides?"
Colin asked.
"I shouldn't take that personally." "I stand by what I wrote. The war on drugs hurt everyone. It became so easy for police officers to meet their arrest quota by busting people for possession and earning overtime by making all those court appearances. How can you investigate a crime if you're making a drug bust or stuck in court?"
Ben exhaled.
And I get that homicides are expensive and time-consuming. That's life, and that's the truth, so no, it's not personal.
Colin started walking again, heading for the entrance.
So you really are here to check on me?
Ben asked as he opened the door and held it there.
I thought we cleared that up 2 minutes ago. It's nothing personal, Ben. Just like you, I'm only doing my job.
Colin walked off. He could feel Morrison's eyes burning a hole in the back of his head as he continued on toward Ian Savage's office. Colin's meeting with Ian was short and sweet. Ian was an affable man with a dry sense of humor. Colin wasn't too surprised by how quick Ian was to defend his best reporter. But he was taken aback by Ian's fondness for the man. In a matter of minutes, he made it clear that Ben Morrison was not only a brilliant reporter, but also like a son to him. On his way out of the building, his phone buzzed. He picked up the call.
Ren here. Good news. I'm holding the warrant to search Peyton White's house in my hot little hand. What are you doing right now? Meet me at White's residence in 10 minutes,
Colin told him.
See you there.
Colin ended the call. As much as he didn't like Morrison, by no means did he want to arrest the wrong man. He would follow the evidence and see where it led him. 44. Once again, Z found herself parked across the street from Arlene Snyder's parents' home. Her original plan for today was to have a chat with Pam Carr, one of Arlene's friends from way back. But she couldn't stop thinking about what Ellis Cash had said about his daughter when they were at the casino.
She's not getting any of this.
And later,
she'll be fine.
Arlene was alive. Z felt it in her core. But she needed proof. And the only way to know for sure would be to take a look inside Dorothy and Ellis Cash's home. If Arlene was alive, the answer was inside that house. There would be some sort of correspondence. A note on a calendar, something. As she stared at their front door, willing it to open, she found her mind wandering, thinking about the kiss. She had read about first kisses before. Fluttering stomachs, the heart skipping a beat, warmth flooding through the body. Describing a kiss that way sounded silly and cliché. But that's exactly what she'd experienced. Along with a rushing sound in her ears that had drowned out the rest of the world. The kiss had been wonderful. And yet, she hadn't heard from Toby since. She'd read about that part of the deal, too. Every article she'd come across said that if a guy didn't call after the first kiss or the first date, then he just wasn't into you. It was that simple. And so she hadn't been to the coffee shop since. At least now she knew why she'd turned over the death card the other day. It stood for the death of their relationship. She released a heavy sigh just as the door to the Cash's house opened and both Dorothy and Ellis walked outside together. Ellis turned back to the door and locked it. Without making any sudden movements, she slid low in her seat, out of sight. Her pulse picked up a notch at the thought that her perseverance might just pay off. It felt like forever before they climbed into the car and drove off. Her insides vibrated as she reached for her bag on the passenger seat. She had packed everything she could possibly need, including tools that would help her break into their house. Breaking and entering. A felony? Not if she didn't get caught. Don't do it. Your dad will be so disappointed in you. He'll never talk to you again. Do it, Z. Hurry up before they come back. You're wasting time. Unlike Francis, Lucy and Marion tended to get uptight in these types of situations. Z ignored the voices and headed out. She didn't bother checking for a key under the mat on the porch. Instead, she made a beeline for the side yard, slid her hand over the fence, and unlatched the gate. Nothing to see here, folks. A dog barked in the neighbor's backyard. The dog spotted her and was trying to stuff his nose through a loose board in the fence. It was a small dog, looked like a miniature schnauzer. Small but loud. She reached inside her bag for the veggie wrap she'd brought in case she got hungry. Hurry, hurry! The voices in her head weren't helping matters. She was removing the foil wrapper as quickly as possible. But the dog was getting louder, its bark sharp and piercing. Finally, she was able to toss her snack over the fence. She prayed the animal liked pesto and hummus spread over a spinach tortilla. It worked. No more barking, thank God. She ran around the house, looking for the sliding glass door she'd seen on a real estate site on the internet when the house had been up for sale years ago. There it was. An outside slider. Perfect. Again, she reached into her bag. This time, she pulled out a pry bar. About 6 inches from the corner, diagonal from the latch, she inserted the pry bar between the door and the door frame. Using a bit of muscle, she tilted the door and heard a click. That one movement lowered the latch, releasing it from the bracket. She put her tool away and opened the door. Way too easy. And a good reminder to tell her dad he better make sure their sliding doors had an inside slider instead of an outside one. She stepped inside. It smelled like apple pie and cinnamon. The floors were so clean she was sure she could eat off them. The interior of the house was much bigger than she'd expected. High ceilings and wide open spaces. She headed straight for the kitchen, which was massive. Lots of granite countertops and a large island in the middle of the room. Her plan was to start in the kitchen and work her way to the bedrooms. As expected, she found an address book in one of many kitchen drawers. She skimmed through the contacts, looking for any clue at all that Arlene was still in their lives. Maybe they used a nickname for their daughter, or had written a cryptic note in the margin. When she realized she'd taken 15 minutes just to go through the address book, she picked up her pace, opening and closing drawers. Silverware, knives, junk drawer, buttons, and tape. Nothing to see here, she thought as she searched the bottom drawer that was filled with drying towels. And that's when she found something very interesting. Beneath the towels were two phones. Burner phones. The type you buy prepaid at Walmart. Burner phones weren't just for criminals. They were for people who wanted to maintain privacy. People like Dorothy and Ellis Cash. Thinking she heard something, she put the phones back where she'd found them and ran to the front window to take a look outside. Nobody was coming up the walkway. No cars pulling into the driveway. The burner phones were a sign that she was on the right track, but they weren't proof. She turned around and ran up the wide-planked wooden stairs. The master bedroom was on the right. They had one of those cool, motorized, adjustable beds that you could move up and down with the push of a button. She was dying to give it a try, but didn't dare waste an extra second. There were stacks of boxes in the closet, mostly shoes and hats. She felt around in coat pockets and purses. No luck there. She checked under the bed, in between the mattresses, in every nightstand drawer. There had to be a note, a phone number, a picture. Something to indicate Penny was right and her mother was still alive. Z opened books lying around, searched the bathroom, and every cabinet and piece of furniture she came across. She searched linen closets and felt behind stacks of fluffy towels in hopes of finding a secret compartment. When she was finished with the upstairs, she headed back down to an extra room near the kitchen. She set her bag on a twin bed with no headboard. An old Singer sewing machine sat in the far corner. Stacks of magazines and books filled two plastic bins. It looked like a guest room, sewing room, and junk room all in one. She was searching the closet in the same manner she'd done upstairs when she heard the main door open and close. Shit! She rushed to the bed, grabbed her bag from where she'd left it, and ran back to the closet and stepped inside. As quietly as possible, she shut the wooden, double-slatted doors. Hunkered down, she made her way to the darkest corner, sank to the floor, and pulled her cell phone from her purse. She had been inside the house for 2 hours. Dumb, dumb, dumb. She should have known they wouldn't stay out very long. Heck, they rarely left their house to begin with. Now what was she going to do? It would be days before they went out again and hours before they headed for bed. She could hear Dorothy and Ellis talking in the other room. This was the second time since working for Jesse that she'd found herself stuck in a closet of a home she shouldn't be in. She was in big trouble. Her phone vibrated. Toby had just texted her.
What's up? Where are you?
At first, she considered ignoring him. He was a jerk. He hadn't even bothered to call her after the big kiss. He thinks he's Romeo.
Don't waste your love on somebody who doesn't value it.
Thus, with a kiss, I die. You sort of forced him to kiss you. If I were him, I wouldn't have called you either. Z lasted less than 2 minutes before giving in. She texted, I'm hiding in a closet at the Cash's house. Toby,
what? Are they home?
Z, yes, in the kitchen. I didn't hear the car pull up. I need help, but I might need to call my other boyfriend since I'm mad at you. Toby,
you have another boyfriend?
Z, of course. After a minute of silence, she typed, no, bad joke. Why haven't you called me? Toby,
I was waiting for you to come to the coffee shop. I went to your office, but you and Jesse have both been gone.
Z, why didn't you text me? Toby,
I don't know. You make me nervous.
Z, I make myself nervous. Please come to the house and knock on the door. Toby,
what would I say?
Z, you're selling Boy Scout cookies. I don't know. Toby,
Boy Scouts don't sell cookies.
Z, really? That's dumb. Z froze when she heard voices. Not the usual voices, but real voices right outside the door. Pick up the phone! She heard a woman she assumed to be Dorothy shout. Z heard footsteps and drawers opening.
Where did you put the phone this time?
It was Ellis Cash talking. She recognized his voice. Cupboards were being opened and closed. Cups rattled. There must have been a phone stashed within the dishes.
Got it,
Ellis said. A minute later,
hello? Arlene, is that you?
Give me that,
Dorothy ordered.
Leave me be,
Ellis said.
I want to talk to my daughter.
A whoosh of silence followed by Ellis talking again. The one-sided conversation was filled with normal things that Z guessed most parents would talk about with their adult children. How are the kids? How's the weather over there in New England? Blah, blah, blah. Except there was nothing normal or blah about this conversation. Kids? New England? What the hell? After further badgering by Dorothy, he must have handed the phone over to his wife, because it was the woman's voice Z heard now.
We delivered the package, just as you asked.
Yes, we used the post office in Auburn this time.
I know. I know.
There is something I need to tell you. It's about Penny.
She's looking for you.
Silence.
Nathaniel is sick. It doesn't sound good. Maybe it's time for you to come home.
Toby, are you there?
Z.
Arlene is alive. I need you to come. Hurry.
Z sneezed, loud. Then she froze. She could no longer hear anyone talking in the kitchen. The phrase, up shit creek without a paddle, came to mind.
Good job, Bright Eyes.
Unsure of what to do next, she did nothing at all. 45. Lacey was nodding off to the sound of Jason's endless chatter. For months, she'd been hoping he would open up to her. But now that he was talking, she didn't care what he had to say. She only wished he would shut up. She'd learned more about her husband in the short time they'd been living underground than she had in the 8 years they'd been married. She'd learned even more about herself. She was no longer the pathetic little girl chained to the bed. If they somehow made it through this ordeal, she would leave Jason and make a new life for herself. She was strong. She could do anything she put her mind to. Jason finally stopped talking and went back to pounding nails around the vent.
Thank you, Jesus.
There were only a few nails left, but the vent cover still wouldn't budge. The constant banging was in perfect rhythm to the pounding inside her head. She was dehydrated. She knew the signs. Headaches, irritability, inability to think clearly, dry mouth, cracked lips and hands. She put a hand to her abdomen.
I'm so sorry, little one.
She had been so desperate to conceive, so eager to become a mother. Every thought of late had been about her unborn baby. He or she was 8 weeks old. Her baby had fingers and toes, but it would be weeks before she felt him or her move. A loud clatter drew her attention. Lacey crossed the distance between them to see what had happened, which wasn't easy considering the ceilings were so low. Had their captor purposely made it so they couldn't stand up tall? She rubbed her back. The vent cover was on the ground. Light spilled through.
Oh my God! You did it!
I told you I would get us out of here.
She groaned. You are a piece of work.
Did I say something wrong?
Ignoring him, Lacey slipped her head up into the vent where she could stand a little straighter. It felt so good to straighten her spine and stretch. The vent was about 2 feet by 2 feet. It was lined with aluminum and stretched out 6 feet to the right before it appeared to lead straight up again. Her heart thumped against her ribs. Feeling suffocated, she closed her eyes and concentrated on breathing. After a moment, her body relaxed and she was able to check out the space. The light coming through was bright. She listened for any sounds coming from above, but the silence was deafening. The smell of sweet, tall grass filled her senses. If they got out of here, she swore she'd never take something so simple as the smell of grass for granted.
What's in there?
Jason asked, nudging her from behind.
What do you see?
She ducked down and moved aside to give him a chance to look for himself. In such a short time, he'd lost at least 15 pounds. He fit right inside, but he was tall and awkward, and she noticed his legs wobbling. Coughing and sputtering, he fell to his knees and then took a seat on the floor.
What's wrong?
I think I heard a rat scurrying around.
A rat was the least of their worries.
It could be our way out of here, she said excitedly. All you have to do is slide your body to the end, where the vent curves upward, and then twist around until you're on your feet.
The taste of freedom made her giddy.
Once you're on your feet, Jason, I'm guessing it's straight up from there and you can just pull yourself right out.
I'm sorry.
Lacey didn't understand.
About what?
I can't do it.
Her shoulders tensed.
Of course you can.
His gaze was directed at his feet as he shook his head.
What if I reminded you of the baby? Your baby.
He looked at her then, his eyes narrowed.
That would be just like you to try and guilt me into something I can't possibly do. I'm much too tall and broad-shouldered to fit in there.
When have I ever, in all the years I've known you, tried to guilt you into doing anything you didn't want to do?
You guilted me into asking you to marry me.
Her stomach turned.
You're insane.
It's true. You were so fragile and innocent. You had no family or friends. After the Brightmans' children were old enough to attend school, you told me you didn't know what you would do with yourself because you would be all alone.
She started laughing then. A deep, hearty belly laugh that she couldn't control. She nearly buckled over in hysterics, especially after she started to hiccup.
You're the one who is insane, not me,
Jason said. He merely stood there, watching her as if she'd lost her mind, which maybe she had.
So that's why you asked me to marry you, huh?
Yes.
It's funny,
Lacey said,
because I remember it all so differently. I had worked for the Brightmans for 10 years when I met you. They paid me well, and I had saved every penny I earned. The minute we were married, you told me you needed $30,000 to start your business.
She poked him in the chest, hard.
You married me for money.
Lacey shook her head in wonder. All this time, I couldn't bring myself to believe it could be true, but it is, isn't it?
He didn't say a word. A hiccup was followed by,
I can't believe it took being buried alive with you to see what a slimy, worthless scumball you truly are.
Not now, Lacey. Don't say things you might regret. We're both hungry and thirsty, exhausted by our ordeal.
Yes, that's true. But I'm not ready to give up. I'm getting out of here. There was no water or food left. Nothing to do but give this a shot. She ducked her head under and into the vent.
Here,
she heard Jason say.
Let me give you a boost.
She didn't need his help. Determined to get out of there, she used her elbows to pull herself high enough to where she could half crawl, half slither through the vent. It was a narrow space, but she had nothing to lose and everything to gain. There would have been no point in waiting another day, let alone another minute.
Are you okay?
Jason asked, his voice sounding farther away than it was.
Can you breathe?
She ignored his false concern as she inched along on her belly like a snake. It only took her a couple of minutes to make her way to the end, where the vent turned upward just as she'd thought. As she pulled herself forward and up, she had to contort her body just a bit so that she could make the turn. The metal siding scraped against her back as she planted her hands on the wall, palms flat, and pulled, grunting and moaning as she made the turn before finally pushing herself to her feet. Elation flooded through her. Swallowing, she tried not to think about being trapped or stuck in such a small, confined space. She wasn't the same person who had been buried deep. She was better, stronger, and nobody was ever going to fuck with her again. Perspiration dripped down her face and neck. She looked up, the sun shining so bright it nearly blinded her. The very top of the vent looked as if it was covered with a wire grate. It was hard to tell how thick the wire was or if it was fastened to anything. Even if she jumped as high as she could, there was no way she would reach the top.
Did you find a way out?
It sounded as if Jason was talking to her through a wall. Again, she ignored him. He could have done this if he'd had the will or the drive to save his family. He might have been able to use his height to his advantage. As it was, she would have to climb at least 8 feet from where she stood. With her feet planted on the walls on both sides, she attempted to Spider-Man her way up the vent. But her feet and the palms of her hands were clammy, and she kept slipping back down to the ground. Lightheadedness threatened to overtake her. She looked up again. So far away. No sooner had the thought floated through her mind than she rested a hand on her belly and massaged her baby bump. She imagined holding her baby in her arms for the first time. Boy or girl, it didn't matter. She swallowed hard. A tear ran down her cheek. She needed to save her baby. Think, she told herself. Think. Her gaze fell on her sleeve. She had ripped it when she'd pulled herself up out of what she assumed was to be her grave. An idea came to her. The hem and the sleeves of her dress were made of faux leather. Adrenaline coursed through her as she ripped the rest of the right sleeve off her arm and pressed it against the aluminum siding. It didn't slip. Maybe if she wrapped the leather around her feet, she could make the climb. It might work. Definitely worth a shot. There wasn't enough room for her to bend forward, so she lifted her right leg as high as possible, just past her knee, then blindly reached down, her face pressed against the aluminum siding as she tied the strip of cloth around her foot. She repeated the process with her left foot. Then she just stood there.
You are strong, she told herself. You can do this.
Straightening, she wiped her hands over the dried dirt caked on her dress for better friction. She sucked in a deep breath. This was it. She was as ready as she'd ever be.
with the palms of her hands planted against the siding. She then pressed her right foot against the wall before doing the same with the left foot. Pushing the palms of her hands and the balls of her feet against the walls, she focused on climbing upward, one inch at a time. It was working. Her heart raced. She was doing it, slow and steady. Her legs shook, calves quivering by the time she drew close to the top. Every muscle tense, she reached up and pushed on the grate. Nothing happened. It wouldn't budge.
No, no, no. Breathe. Just breathe.
She pushed again, harder this time. Sweat ran down her face and back. She gritted her teeth, determined to give herself more time. The wire bent upward. Not much, but it was something. She used her fingers to circle the outer edge of the grate, looking for wires or metal clasps that might be keeping it from budging. Nothing but dirt and grass. Jason called out from below. Every muscle in her body burned. It sounded as if Jason had stuck his head into the vent again. He was practically screaming, his voice panicked.
You're not going to leave me in here to die, are you?
Her legs quivered. She wouldn't last much longer before falling back to where she'd started.
Concentrate. You can do this.
If she didn't find a way to push through the grate, she wasn't sure she'd have the strength to make it to the top again. She closed her eyes, counted to three, and let out a roar as she thought about everything she'd been through. She thought of her stepdad and the driver and Jason, and she pushed with every bit of strength left inside of her. The grate sprang free, toppling over on its side, out of sight. A feeling of weightlessness flooded through her as she inched her way upward until her head poked out into open air, and she was able to prop her elbows on the tall, grassy weeds and hold herself in place. She took a few seconds to catch her breath and regain some strength. Pain shot through her arms and legs a minute later when she pushed and pulled her way through the top. She inhaled the scent of soil and wet grass. She smiled, then fell backward in exhaustion. She closed her eyes. Tears rolled down the side of her face. Again, she rested her hands on her stomach.
We made it. We're free.
46. Until Jesse Cole came snooping around, he'd spent his time watching and listening to Jason and Lacey, surprised they hadn't noticed the miniature camera stuffed inside a small hole in the corner of the cement room. They never even found the screwdriver he'd buried with them to help break through the particle board. Lacey Geiger was a clever girl, though, and she'd found a way. She was much smarter than her husband. Anxiety was setting in. His insides wouldn't stop quivering, and his legs bounced whenever he sat down. He needed to stay calm. He would call a tow truck and have the car he'd been driving that night hauled away. He shook his head. Never in a million years had he thought anyone would come here looking for Jason Geiger. It was inconceivable. Hot tea with lemon might help. Just as he stepped into the kitchen, he glanced out into the backyard and thought he saw something move. The cattle weren't anywhere near the underground room. Maybe it was a coyote? He stood there for a few minutes longer, straining his eyes. A head popped up. He grabbed his binoculars from the kitchen drawer and looked again. There it was again. No fucking way. She had done it. Lacey Geiger had somehow managed to climb out of the fucking vent. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. He ran to the couch where he'd left his boots and tugged them on, didn't bother tying the laces. His heart raced, making him feel as if he were going to have a heart attack. Before he could get to the door leading to the backyard, he heard gravel crunching and popping under tires. Someone was here. Fuck, fuck, fuck. He tried to remember if he'd ordered anything from Amazon. His mind went blank. He rushed over to the front door and peeked through the viewer. It was her. Jesse Cole had returned. His chest tightened. He knew what needed to be done. It was her fault. She never should have come. 47. The first thing Jesse noticed when she pulled into Brody Hoffman's driveway was the car she'd seen the last time she visited. She pulled up close to the vehicle and turned off the engine. Something didn't feel right. Despite the dented back bumper and broken window, the car looked fairly new. There was no rust or other signs that would signal that the vehicle had been sitting in the driveway for very long. Her senses on high alert, she grabbed her gun from the glove compartment and slid it into the holster at her waist. She then readied the tape recorder inside her purse, climbed out of the car, and walked to the door. Before she could knock a third time, Brody Hoffman opened the door. Unlike the last time she'd come to visit, this time he appeared to be all smiles. Either he was guilty as sin, or she was paranoid.
"I'm glad you're here,"
he said, out of breath. She lifted a brow in question.
"I was going to call you. After you left, I thought about it for a while, and I came up with a few places Jason might have gone to get away from it all."
"That's great." He nodded.
"Come in."
She stepped inside. From the looks of it, he'd spruced the place up a bit, swept the floors and dusted the tables, but still no female touches such as flowers or decorative pillows on the couch. They both took a seat at the same table in the kitchen where they had sat last time. A sheen of sweat covered his forehead. He glanced over his shoulder toward the field where cattle grazed. She followed his gaze, trying to see what he was looking at, but all she saw was a field of tall green grass, a few trees, and a bunch of cows in the far distance. "Is everything okay?" Jesse asked.
"I've been having problems with the water line. I thought I saw water gushing earlier. I should probably make sure there are no major leaks before we get started. It won't take me long."
"Perfect. That would give her time to check the bedroom." She nodded. "I'll wait right here." As soon as he was out the door and had walked far enough away, Jesse popped up out of the chair and rushed to the bedroom. The chair was still in the corner, but the clothes and the purse were gone. She took a quick look under the bed. She checked the closet next. Her eyes widened when her gaze fell on what she was looking for. There it was. He'd tossed everything into a heap. Her heart raced as she grabbed the purse, unzipped the middle section, and reached inside. She found a wallet. Her hands shook as she opened it and looked inside. There was $32 in cash, plus credit cards and a driver's license. Lacey Geiger. Brody Hoffman had kidnapped the Geigers. Had he picked them up under the guise of being a transportation service? No time to think about that now. She needed to find Lacey. The wood floor creaked behind her. A shadow fell over her. She glanced over her shoulder as she reached for the gun tucked into her waistband. Brody Hoffman stood over her, holding a bat, ready to take a swing. She twisted the other way just as it connected with her skull. A bright white light exploded behind her eyes. She felt dizzy, disoriented. Her stomach roiled. By the time her senses returned and she knew what was happening, he had dragged her into the main room. She reached for the top of her head where he'd hit her. She was lucky he hadn't bashed her head in. If she hadn't seen him coming, she'd be dead. Her fingers brushed against something wet and sticky. When she looked at her hands, they were covered in blood. A rushing sound filled her ears, like waves crashing against the shore. Fuck! Her blood phobia was kicking in. She was going to faint. "Don't do it! Don't you dare pass out now!" Her head fell back to the floor, and the room spun and turned black. 48. Lacey lay on the damp grass, catching her breath, when she heard a rustling in the grass nearby. A twig snapped. She opened her eyes. A man stood above her, looking down at her with the same flat, expressionless eyes as the driver. It was him. The man with the mask. Their driver. A bloody baseball bat dangled from his hand. She sat up, scooting away from him.
Stop right there. You're not going anywhere.
She should have run the moment she climbed out of the hole. She took in the vast fields of tall grass and the slope of a hill past a wood fence. Behind him, she saw a one-story house. Was anyone inside? Would they call for help if she screamed? Why are you doing this? She asked, trying to buy time. He smirked.
Because your husband needed to be stopped. He's a ruthless bastard who cares only about himself. I used to be a decent guy, married, looking forward to having children. Ring a bell? Jason Geiger ruined my life. I thought it was time I did the same for him.
Escape. Get away. She put a hand on her belly. I'm pregnant. Please don't hurt my baby.
I've been listening to the two of you down there. How could you be so stupid? 8 long years and you know nothing about your husband.
I saw what he wanted me to see.
Her fingers dug into the soil, gathering dirt. He snorted.
I think you saw what you wanted to see.
Lacey was about to make her move when he turned and walked toward the garden hose a few feet away. She jumped to her feet and ran, stumbling through clods of dirt. Jason shouted from below, but she didn't dare stop. Every muscle burned as she ran toward the fence. Her pulse raced. It wasn't until he grunted that she knew he was close behind her. Suddenly, a hand grabbed a fistful of hair and yanked her backward. She gasped for air and then let out a primal scream. Someone would hear her. They had to. He jerked her back. A sharp pain sliced through her head. She twisted around and kicked his leg, but he was unaffected.
You're too weak to fight me,
he told her. She screamed again and tossed dirt in his face. He sputtered, then dragged her back to the spot where he'd left the nozzle.
Do that again, and I'll kill you right now and drop you down that hole so you and your husband can be reunited.
Her chest rose and fell with each breath she took as she watched the man drop the hose into the hole.
What's going on?
Jason shouted up at them.
Who is there with you?
The man laughed.
God, listening to him, you wouldn't know Jason Geiger was such a brutally cold-hearted man, would you?
His gaze remained on hers while he sent more and more hose down the vent.
I bet this experience has opened your eyes, huh?
Lacey didn't want to anger him, so she nodded. She needed a plan. If she could get more space between them, she could make another run for it. Head for the house and hope for the best.
So tell me, what do you think of your husband now?
She swallowed, afraid to answer and say the wrong thing. His face contorted.
I'll tell you what he is. He's self-centered, impulsive, callous, and manipulative. He'll trample on anyone he has to if it means making a buck.
He marched back to the faucet and turned the water on full blast. She'd come too far to die now. She jumped to her feet and took off running again, this time toward the house. The dirt was more compact, easier to run on. There was no way she was going to stop. She heard water rushing. Jason was shouting, his voice lined with panic. And 2 seconds later, the bat slammed against the back of her knees. A searing, white-hot pain shot through her as she went down, hitting the dirt hard.
You dumb bitch!
She could hardly move. One of her legs was broken, she was certain of it. Pain rattled her brain as he grabbed her arm and hauled her back to the vent opening she'd just crawled out of. He dropped his hold on her. Gritting her teeth, the pain agonizing, she let her head fall back on the grass. Fuck. Her right leg was useless. The pain excruciating. It was over. She'd tried. She inwardly apologized to her unborn child. She never meant to put the baby in harm's way, but that was what she'd done. She'd wanted the perfect marriage so badly that she'd allowed herself to be blinded by all else. She wasn't afraid to die.
but she was distraught to think she would never hold her baby in her arms. From where Lacey lay, she watched as he made his way to a stack of bins. He set the bat to the side, slipped on thick gloves, and then grabbed the top bin. It had air holes on the sides. He carried it to the vent opening, pulled off the lid, then dumped a pile of wriggling snakes into the opening. Down in the hole, Jason began to scream. The man pulled off his gloves and dropped them where he stood. He then grabbed her arm again and dragged her along with him across the field toward the house. The house, she thought. If she could find a weapon to use against him, there might still be hope.
Help me!
Jason called out.
Help me!
The man imitated in a chilling voice. 49. Jessie awoke to the sight of blood on the floor and all over her hands. She broke out in a cold sweat, and again the room began to spin. No, no, no. She tensed the muscles in her arms, legs, and body for as long as she could manage, just as her therapist had her do in his office to stop from fainting. He'd made her watch countless videos of people having blood drawn while she tensed her muscles. As she took her next breath, she felt her body relax. It was working. Ignoring the throbbing pain in her head, she reached for her gun just as the door to the backyard opened. Jessie fell limp, pretending to be unconscious. She heard footsteps as he came into the room. He jabbed her in the side with his booted foot, and when she didn't respond, he turned and walked back toward the kitchen. He was talking to someone now, rambling on about Jason Geiger. Jessie pushed herself to her feet, legs wobbling as she hid within a small alcove by the TV. From where she stood, she could see a woman on the floor near the kitchen table. Brody Hoffman hovered over her. The woman sat up and reached for her leg. That was when Jessie saw her face. It was Lacey.
It's too bad I'm forced to harm innocent people,
she heard Brody say as he opened a drawer in the kitchen.
But this isn't my fault. Jason had to be dealt with, and I was the only one willing to make him pay for all the lives he's ruined.
You've gotten your revenge, Lacey told him. Jason is scared to death. He's learned his lesson.
Still defending that man after all he's done to you?
If you kill either of us, you'll spend the rest of your life in prison. That doesn't sound like a satisfying resolution to me.
He snorted.
Well, you're not me.
He bent down and grabbed her arm, dragging her along with him as he said,
Come on, let's go watch Jason fight off those poisonous snakes. I want to see him suffer a slow and horrifying death. I think you'll enjoy it too.
His boots thumped against the floor as he started toward the living room. When he stepped into the main living area, Jessie noticed his gaze fall to the spot on the floor where she'd been lying unconscious only moments ago. He pulled Lacey upward, hard and fast, and held her tight against his chest as if using her as a shield to protect himself.
Where did you go, Jessie Cole?
Jesse's gaze fell to the weapon in his hand. He'd replaced the bat for a knife and held the blade at Lacey's throat.
Come out of hiding, Brody said, or I'll cut her throat right now.
Jessie stepped out into the middle of the room, her arms straight in front of her, both hands on the gun, finger on the trigger, aiming for his head. The room began to spin. Inhale, exhale. The dizziness passed.
Well, look at you,
he said, his voice eerily calm.
I don't believe you're supposed to have a gun in your possession. Isn't that right? Do you really want to get in trouble with the authorities again?
Put the knife down,
she said, hoping the quiver in her voice went undetected.
And then I want you to get down on the floor, face down, hands on your back.
His eyes pierced hers. The corners of his mouth turned upward in a malicious grin. Refusing to let him intimidate her, Jessie held her ground.
Get down on the floor now, she stated firmly.
After all I've been through, all the years of planning, you think I'm going to spend the rest of my life in jail?
I know what Jason Geiger did to you. It wasn't right. You're not the only one whose life was ruined by the man. Don't give him the power. You can put a stop to all of this right now.
I lost everything because of that man.
You can start over, Jesse told him.
I lost my business, my pride, my wife.
Jesse didn't know why, but she felt strangely connected to this man. It probably had something to do with all the people she'd talked to who despised Jason. Brody Hoffman had been dealt a hard blow by a selfish man, and it was obvious the burning hatred he had for Jason Geiger had turned into a wildfire.
If you let Lacey go, they'll be lenient on you. You haven't killed anyone, Brody. I'll make sure you get the help you need to turn your life...
Shut up! You have no idea what it's like to be shamed and humiliated in front of friends and family. For nearly a year, I felt naked, on display for all to see. It's over, for all of you. I'm done talking.
Lacey jabbed an elbow into his side, then lowered her head and bit his arm, catching him off guard. He cursed, pushed her away. Lacey dropped to the floor, but she wasn't done. The wild expression on her face gave Jesse chills as she watched Lacey grab hold of his leg and bite into his calf. Brody shook her off and turned toward Jesse. Remembering what Colin had told her at the gun range, Jesse forced herself to relax as she took the slack off the trigger, aimed for his shoulder, and pressed. But Brody shifted his body suddenly, and the bullet struck him in the chest. He didn't crumple to the floor or stagger backward. He merely stood there and stared at Jesse and mouthed, "Thank you." Lacey scrambled away, dragging her injured leg behind her. Brody Hoffman wanted to die, but Jesse wanted him to live. With the gun still aimed in his direction, Jesse said,
"Drop the knife, Brody. Please."
Instead, he pointed the tip of the blade at her, his hand shaking. Jesse felt desperate to find a way to put a stop to all this. He was in a dark place. If she could only find a way to make him see that in any given situation, there was always a way out. Always. The hand gripping the knife shook as he squared his shoulders. His eyes. The rage had left him, leaving in its wake a dull, empty stare. Jesse took a step toward him, pleading for him to give it up. He twisted the knife in his hand and plunged the blade deep into his chest above his heart. Jesse gasped. He fell to his knees, relief softening his face before he toppled over. She rushed to his side. Blood gushed from his wounds. He wouldn't last long.